LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour.
Hello, and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Kate Wolf, and I'm joined by my two lovely co-hosts, Medea Ocher and Eric Newman.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, guys. And this week, we're doing a special discussion show about the morality of memoir.
Mm-hmm.
That we wanted to talk about this just because there's been so much recently in the news and in the media cycle about either personal essay, who has the right to tell other people's stories, kind of trying to maneuver around stories that include other people and not give all the details. It's a perennial topic, but it seems to have come back with full force. And we also wanted to discuss this topic because the next LARB book club book that, Dea, you will be discussing with readers is Molly by Blake Butler, which kind of exemplifies a lot of these issues and has been praised as well as criticized for some of the questions we're discussing. So we thought that this would be a perfect way to get into the book club pick.
Yeah. And it has been in the ether in a way that I feel like is a little bit unusual. I don't really, where it's really come to a head, where people are just talking about like the, what are the morals of writing about yourself and including other people's stories in it. So yeah, this kind of felt like good timing.
And maybe we should start it off by just, you know, Dea, you and I both read Molly because we interviewed Blake.
Right.
Eric, I'm not sure if you did, but maybe you...
No. I haven't read it, but okay. I have read much of the controversy around it.
Okay, maybe we should just, you know, start by talking about that, how we feel about this controversy, what some of it is, the, you know, the validity of it.
Yeah. So the controversy partly also started because tabloids picked up the story, which is like pretty unusual for a literary book. Page Six posted about it, and I think Daily Mail, which is nuts because like these are not celebrities, really. I mean, literary maybe, but.
Right.
And they posted all of the sort of lurid details that appear in Blake's book without really providing any of the actual like literary context about how those lurid details are presented or how the book includes them. You know, it's just the sort of salacious sex pics and like.
You should also explain that the sex is sex that Molly Brodeck had with people that she had affairs that were not known to Blake, her husband, as they were happening and were only discovered after her death.
Right. So actually, Eric, I'm kind of curious, as a person who didn't read the book, what was your sense about like how it was presented in the tabloids and in the media?
Yeah, so the tabloids, I mean, you can understand why the tabloids would run with this. I mean, because it is tabloid fodder. Like, the headline is, writer discovers while getting photos from deceased wife's phone that she has, in fact, had all kinds of affairs. And not just affairs, like, she's kind of been whatever the straight people version of Grindr is. It's like, that's kind of what she's been doing. And that she, there is also the suggestion, which I believe from what I've read, Butler makes towards the end of the book, that she may also have been having affairs with students of hers. So I think that these kind of, and we should also say, her death was a suicide. So you've got like a perfect storm of salacious details, a suicide, a grieving husband discovers rampant infidelity and possibly also grooming of students. Like, especially for conservative-edged tabloids, this is like the trifecta. So I can absolutely see that. I will say, in terms of the other coverage that I read about it, the more, let's say, even-handed or thoughtful coverage of it, it's hard for me, not having read it, to maybe not see it as motivated a little bit by revenge or some kind of, at the very least, I think some anger and deep pain, you know? And I think that this is one of the things that we might frame our discussion around is kind of, you know, like, what is this piece of writing serving? Like, what audience is it serving? How is it serving the writer? And I think that I would be very sympathetic to the argument that, based on the details that I've read around it, without being very clear, not having read the book, that it is serving a kind of revenge desire for a writer who feels deeply harmed and wronged by a woman who also left his life in an incredibly dramatic and traumatic way.
You know, what's so interesting in the book is that it's really, it seems to come, I don't know if so much from revenge, but yes, definitely anger. And also this impulse to kind of like be a testament to Molly and make sure that she isn't forgotten. Like, it had a lot of competing impulses, I thought. And also just when you're a writer and something awful happens to you or in your life, I understand that the impulse is to write about it. Right. That is how you process. Yeah. That is a normal impulse. You know, I lost one of my closest friends to suicide. And of course, immediately I was trying to write about it because that's mm-hmm. when you have these kind of stories, where else would you put them? So that's something I understood from the book, that there was also just a really human impulse to process.
Sure.
But maybe coming so close to the event, there was so much going on. Maybe it wasn't completely able to be sorted through in this neat way that narrative sometimes requires. So it has a messy feeling of a book. Like, there's a lot going on, but I didn't think of it as like revenge porn in any way. I thought of it just as, but it does introduce something towards the end that maybe doesn't quite collide with everything else in the book or seems at odds with it. So there is a tension there for sure.
I just want to say that the revenge thing, I was actually picking that word specifically from one of her friends
right.
who had said that that's what she felt it was. The other thing in terms of, I totally get what you're saying about the processing, and this is more my deeply cynical read, is that his, which came up in a couple of articles, his kind of claim that he wants to present Molly in all of her, you know, as the wonderful artist that she was, to me is, I can understand that, but it is also this, who benefits? He is the executor of her estate. So like any kind of further publicity of her books, he stands to materially benefit
Whoa,
from.
Whoa, Eric, that's, you know? That is deeply
that's
cynical.
That's dark. Yeah, that's really dark.
I mean, but I'm saying we're talking about a business. That's the other thing. Books are business.
Yeah.
Just barely for most books, but yeah. I don't think those poetry volumes are going to be selling out, you know what I mean? Yeah. But sure, that is true.
But maybe they'll sell now because that book did so well.
Maybe. The poetry, probably not. I'm curious, Deo, what you think.
I think I agree with you, Kate. I agree. It did not feel revenge-like to me. It didn't feel driven by that impulse at all. To me, it felt more like grief, driven by grief rather than revenge and anger, although there's definitely a lot of conflicting emotions within it that I think Blake is skilled and smart enough not to hide. I think, in fact, it would have been a disservice to himself and to Molly to hide the various ways in which, or the various feelings that drove the writing of the book, right? Like, I think it's actually better to be sort of transparent about what those feelings might be, even if some of those feelings are not so attractive, even if they are anger or resentment or, you know, all of those other things. I think that's actually part of the power of the book. I think part of the thing, too, that I'm always interested in or like thinking about is like, is the ways in which like messiness collides with ethics, that I think that there's ways in which a really neat narrative is actually more ethically complicated because it's trauma aesthetically presented in a contained, neat way, or experience rather, not just trauma, obviously. And there's something about that that feels like a little bit tricky to me in terms of like the ethics of that kind of presentation of something that is actually in fact complicated, that is messy, that perhaps shouldn't be totally neat.
I also think here, you know, the book, it kind of makes me think of one of my favorite books ever that I read all the time, which is Sylvia by Leonard Michels.
Oh,
which is also the story of his, you know, it's a novel, but I believe it is a memoir. And for the most part, I don't know if there's things that are invented in it, but it's based on this true story of his wife, his first wife, who committed suicide, and their tormented relationship. It is a very skillfully told book. The lines are just like breathtaking and concise, and it really does enrapture you. And I think it has enraptured me so much at times that when I've given it to people to read, you know, they're like, why would you give me this book? It's awful. Like, they're both awful people. And I don't feel that way at all. I really, you know, like, feel for Leonard Michaels in this book, because he has little by little, through the way he writes, put me on his side, as much as he also is really open about his madness as well as hers in the relationship. But I think that there is something also that it's from a very subjective place. You know, he is just trying to tell his story of this relationship with this woman. And maybe where Molly also gets more complicated is that it is also, I think, serving as kind of this biography for Molly, this testament to Molly Brodick as a writer, not to forget her, kind of narrating her life without her there, as opposed to just Blake Butler's experience of their relationship, which, again, I understand when someone has been a public figure, that seems like a very natural impulse to me, to want to also ensure their legacy. But then in a book where there's all these other things swirling around, that it gets complicated. So I think there's also this difference between telling your side of the story, telling your story, and then also simultaneously trying to kind of tell someone else's story too, which is a natural offshoot, even if you're telling your story. But the book seems to be doing two things at once, which I think puts people on edge a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like we should talk about this, like, the business part of this. I think that's, like, a pretty interesting point. And also one of the things that I've been thinking about with this, like, with this rise of the personal essay from a particular magazine that just hits it out of the park every single time. It's The Cut. The Cut at New York Magazine, they're just, like, fantastic at somehow finding these stories that are extraordinarily revealing. And in that situation, it's really hard not to think about the business side of things, particularly as an editor, because what I'm seeing when I see those is like, oh, this is one click after another, baby. Like, this is smart.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the business part of it is super interesting.
Okay, so let's think about the business from two ways. So one, I totally get you have your editor hat on and you're like, just like the people at the Daily Mail did, I'm sure. It's like, oh, yes, this is a headline I can write, and this is a story people will read. I'm curious about it for the writer. So on the one hand, I would hazard a guess that The Cut does not so much go after people to recruit them to write these things as they are known as a place where one can write highly shared, possibly viral content. And the price of entry is your deepest, darkest, most horrible and salacious feelings and experiences, right? So I'm just curious, my guess is there's a larger cultural thing that is happening here, but what is in it for the author? There's the virality, sure, but the author gets what? I mean, we don't know the rate, but my guess just off the top of my head is probably $500. Is what you're getting to tell some of the word. I mean, Medea's
gotta,
like,
be,
you
more.
Know, kind
it's
of,
gotta
it,
be more.
It might
more,
be more.
Think,
but yeah.
It might be more. Okay. All right. Is it more than 1,000? Do you imagine it's more than 1,000?
I don't know, but it's possible.
But if you write like a 5,000 word essay for The Cut, I'm sure. I don't know. Well, maybe people will let us know.
Yeah,
maybe
we'll
let us.
Yeah.
Tell us
please
your
respond.
Rates. Yeah,
email yeah. us. Yeah. But let's say at the outside edge, 1,500. That is not a life-changing amount of money, and you're putting a significant amount. Like, what I would think is like, okay, if I were, not that I have such a story, dear listeners, but like, if I were to make this Faustian bargain, I get, like, my name really circulates out there. Maybe it's promoting a book that I'm trying to bring out. But I have now told this terrible story, probably very damaging to people in my family or to my husband or whatever. I don't get the appeal. Like, is that really serving the, why would someone want to do this?
Oh my God. I mean, because you get attention and you probably, you know, if it was viral enough, I'd assume also you get a, possibly get a book deal out of it. I would okay. think. I think there's a difference.
But
too.
I'm the cynical one.
Yeah. I mean, no. Why else? I know. I mean, that's the thing. And I was trying to prepare for this. I looked up this Edward St. Aubyn profile that was in the New Yorker. And if anyone doesn't know, Edward St. Aubyn is a novelist who has this horrific story of being raped by his father. And instead of writing a memoir about it, he wrote the cycle of novels about it. And the book was saying that the kind of stories that Edward St. Aubyn has in his book, you know, like in British bookstores, there's a basically like a traumatic lives section of the book with titles like, you know, Please No Daddy, and like My Life Was Ruined, Mommy, and you know. So I think there's, I feel like, yes, not everyone has these stories, but there's, it's also the way that they are told, again, like coming back to these formal hinges for everything that hold them up and change kind of the flavor of whatever it is. So in terms of just cashing in as quickly as possible on trauma, the kind of personal essay industrial complex, as I've seen it called on the online parlance, that was also very popular, you know, about 10 years ago, that seems to be resurfacing now, I think, for people who don't want to spend the time or who can't afford to spend the time, you know, crafting their thoughtful memoir. There's this other avenue to possibly then getting the time to craft it, which is like you make a big splash and then maybe you can get a book deal. But then for a lot of people, I think you publish these stories that there's a hunger for. You are sharing like these really traumatic, deep things, or yes, like possibly bringing some extra scrutiny to your family or your partner or whatever, you know, and then you don't get much out of it because really like it's a dime a dozen when it comes to traumatic stories in the world. And people just move on to the next.
Yeah. But I think there are, and like, you know, like I think somebody like Emily Gould, who did recently write this kind of essay for The Cut about her divorce and then a mental break and then sort of changing, getting better and then maintaining her relationship with her husband, who's also a writer, Keith Gessen. You know, with I think somebody like Emily Gould, like I actually think this is kind of her art. I don't think that it's separate from, I think that this kind of writing is her art form. Because one, I think I am very much inclined to read it as like a really incredible, really well-crafted essay on something that is very, very revealing, not particularly attractive maybe in a lot of ways in terms of like what it reveals about oneself. But we all have relationships and traits like that, right? Like, I think that's like undeniable. And so the thing that I really admire about it is that I think it kind of, with Emily Gould, like it, one, she has like a real history of writing this kind of work, even starting at like Gawker and stuff like that, but that it kind of puts her in line with like other sort of almost formal and formal movements that have done this kind of thing. Like, New Narrative, for example, I Love Dick, Chris Krauss, right? Like people who are revealing things about themselves in their writing, whether it's presented as fiction or nonfiction or something in between, but that actually formally sort of pushes what literature is or what an essay is or what, and maybe what Emily Gould is doing is like the internet version of that. You know, like Chris Krauss did the sort of like, I'm faxing Dick these like crazy letters, and then I will gather them and publish them into a book. And Gould's version is like the rise of the internet, the rise of the blog, the rise of this kind of other sort of way in which one presents one's personal life for the consumption of others. But it also makes it into like a distinct art form. So I think that's also something to think about. Like, I really think she's like a, and I don't think every writer who does this is like this, actually. Like, I think she's kind of an exception. But I think there's something to be said for it to be like part of maybe not visible now, but what is going to be a visible sort of formal movement, artistic movement.
So I think that essay, which is called The Lore of Divorce, that I read and really enjoyed for its honesty. I also think it's different when you're, as opposed to kind of being an up-and-coming writer who has nothing to lose and wants to get noticed and is willing to kind of divulge all the facts or whatever, all the whatever's happened in your eyes of your life, of being someone who is more established and who, you know, as people get more well-known, sometimes they become more guarded with personal information. They refuse to share as much. And in this case, I thought it was a very frank essay that, you know, stood to, I know a lot of people who did not like it and who thought that she came off as completely unself-aware and so annoying and they would dump her. What about poor Keith? But I did not feel that way at all. I thought it was a really, really honest piece of writing that talked about kind of like domestic problems in an honest way. And another thing I feel like criticism was like, you know, they have so much money. They don't even, they have this extra bedroom, all this stuff. But I also, you know, so I'm sure for a certain, for someone who is like a working class person, some of the, you know, griping about money and takeout sounds ridiculous. But I also thought the kind of cold, hard numbers of the finances, which sometimes for people are the biggest taboo of all, to share that, you know, to me seems transgressive almost. As we were talking with Robert Gluck about Eric, do you remember how he's saying, like, in that bathhouse when he's getting a blowjob and then he tells someone, like, what his salary is as a teacher, and everyone was like, oh, take that number out because it wasn't the sex but the money that was the more explosive detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
But you didn't like the essay, Eric, so talk about it.
I think my reaction to the essay, so not a criticism, I do think that what Medea is saying is, yeah, Emily Gould is a master of the form. So there is, like, sometimes it's a little hard for me to pull apart the kind of, like, oh, the formal mastery, the kind of, for lack of a better, for a more felicitous phrase, like the good writing here, which is very good writing. It's good pacing, all of that rubs up for me against the type that she is describing. So, for example, it is almost laughably anticipatable in this essay that her affair should have occurred at a yoga retreat that she cannot go back to. Okay? I mean, like, there's a way in which we kind of all might have seen that coming down the road, right? There is very much also the post-2000s Brooklyn type of it all, too. And I think for me, it fits into, I don't think actually that there is any lack of self-awareness. I actually think that this is, I think that Emily Gould is a very self-aware writer. I think that in this essay in particular, I am not sure that she is offering us something different or novel. I do absolutely agree with what you're saying, Kate, that it is very honest. I think that's part of its self-awareness. But, you know, what we have here are kind of very well-worn tropes. Like, there's a way in which none of this story, I mean, she does have a break and is in a mental hospital. So I'm not saying that that is an everyday thing. But the kind of gripes about the marriage, the career envy, which also wobbles a little bit, like the feeling about her husband publishing a book, which she's initially supportive of, and then she's not supportive of. And I do understand that it's because it was about raising a child that in her account, he kind of didn't really raise.
Well, I mean, but I also think that, and I feel like this is the irony, and maybe this is kind of another way to move forward in talking about the morality of memoir, is that she was supportive of this book, but then the book was telling her story. The book was describing her birth. So for two writers, I can imagine where you're like, more than even just two people in a family, it's like, what's mine to write about and what's yours?
Sure, but she knew that. She did know that. She read it before. And it was only when a fact checker from The New Yorker was calling her to ask about this particularly gruesome detail of the birth that she does not have access to in her own memory. I get that. This seems like it was kind of a, like, after the fact, and she says it several times, like, as the publication day approached, that's when she started to get second-guess feelings.
But I also think that's in part because it's like, I read this Philip Lopate essay and where he talks about kind of writing about people and how to navigate that. And do you show people? He doesn't like to show people, you know, a draft before to kind of get their okay on the way that they've been depicted. But this very human feeling of like, your story will be taken from you and read by all these people, and you don't have a say in how you're depicted. You know, that there's something that does feel like you've stolen my life from me, and now there's no room for me to kind of except to write my own response, to write my own memoir in return, you know, which is, but I really don't think people like reading about themselves. Even if it's, I just think there is something really uncomfortable in becoming a subject that everyone feels. And especially if it's like, who gets to write this? Who does the experience belong more to? And when we're talking, yes, about like, you know, who has the right to tell the story? Which seems like, even to go back to Blake Butler, like, what's his right to tell this story of Molly's infidelities? You know, like, is it his right? I just think that there'll never be a satisfactory answer in that case, because Molly's no longer alive, but would she bridle if they had just gotten a divorce and she had lived and this was the depiction of his like divorce memoir? I'm sure.
Well, Kate, I mean, I think this gets into your personal, we didn't know this until we sort of started talking about having this chat show, but Kate, you revealed that you were in fact written about.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
By my mom in an essay for an anthology on empty nesters.
How was it?
And it was, oh my God, it was all about how I was so dirty and I brought in a bunch of vegetables and I just left them, which is totally true. I don't put my vegetables in bags. I put my dirty vegetables in the, you know, in the crisper in the fridge, and there's got dirt all over the place and my shoes by the door, and what a, you know, like, ungrateful daughter I had been. You know, it was loving and kind of like a bittersweet portrayal. But it hurt. I cried. I hated the feeling of it. And I felt like it was completely unfair and very one-sided, you know?
Did you know it was coming?
No. I don't think she didn't warn me about it. But
how did you find out?
I think she might have given me the book after, you know, when it was published. Oh. She went the Philip Lopate way of like, here's something I wrote about you. Now it's out in a book. But it was meant to be loving. I just remember it stinging and feeling like, oh, she doesn't get me. She doesn't see me. She got this wrong. Even though I'm saying the thing about the vegetables is totally true. And then it wasn't like a conscious revenge, but many years later, I wrote this review essay on mothers and daughters and kind of like caretaking for M+1. And, you know, in the last paragraph, I get a little like dissing on my mom and her mothering when I was young. And even like now, you know, like she told me, oh, like, you know, when I was about my son, she said, just let him watch movies all day. She's like, that's what I did when you were his age. I let you watch 3 movies a day.
Whoa.
He was 3 when she said this, you know? I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that's really messed up. But of course she said, oh, what you said wasn't accurate. I don't think it was very real.
Oh, she thought that.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
She didn't go as far, I think, as I did, which was tears, but she definitely gave a kind of eye roll. And she wasn't saying like, oh, I love this essay. You really touched on something. It was like, good job, sweetie.
Was the stuff in her essay and in your essay in response like things you'd talked about before? Or was it like the first time you were seeing her frustration about like you dragging dirty things into the house?
Well, great point. No, she never mentioned that to me. But I mean, in terms of the kind of pain and difficulty in the relationship, I was very aware
right.
of that.
Well, sure.
As is she. I hadn't particularly known that the vegetables bothered her, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that did make it smart a little bit more, where it's like, oh, you didn't even tell me this was an issue.
It's strange. I remember I had one of the first pieces I think I wrote for LARB was about K-dramas, and it included like a very close relationship that I had with a friend of mine with whom I am still close, but we had a kind of like a moment where we were apart. Like nothing had happened, but it was like we kind of had drifted apart. And I remembered asking him, so I did not go the low pate way, but that is also because I am a people pleaser and very anxious about people's reactions. I'm sure there's some trauma formation there as well. But I had talked to him about it and said, you know, I'm going to publish this and it does mention you. And he read it. And I remember him writing back to me and being like, is this how you remember the end of that like period? Because like, I remember it a little differently. And I forget what his account was. And I can't even really remember what mine was either. But that basically was like, oh, I felt like you had just kind of like shut me out or whatever. And we ended up having like, it was actually kind of great because we then reconnected over this piece. But it was definitely one of those moments. And I wonder if you experienced this too, Kate, where you have the sudden sense that like, wait, maybe my memory is inaccurate, or did I do something wrong? Had I harmed somebody and I was actually writing my version of the story in a way that kind of papered over that harm or somehow attempted to make me not look like somebody who had abandoned a friend or whatever it might be?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, I passed along this Jamie Hood essay about Molly that was in book forum. It was in the beginning, it's kind of asking the same question, like really who's to this tension between what truly happened in our memories of experience. And I know that, yes, having written now autobiographically about this one period in my life, I can see the story very differently. Like revisiting the story now in terms of what I actually experienced at the time and what I thought was happening, pulling back a bit and writing it down, I see my part in it being very different. And knowing what I know now about my passive aggressive streak and the way I don't communicate and seeing all these ways that I just didn't say these things, yeah, I think, oh, like I played a different role in this than I originally thought. And ultimately, maybe that's the benefit of writing, of life writing, is that hopefully you do see things you didn't before. And there is kind of room for like a revisionary intervention into the narrative that you've set of your life. And that the writing is kind of exciting because of that. It's not just a, you know, direct narration of the story that you've told yourself for so long. People get really stale when they tell the same story about experience over and over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that this makes me think about a lot is, you know, something that you sort of learn as a parent, or that I have kind of learned as a parent, is that one of the things that you can provide your child is a way to narrativize their experience, because before they can actually talk about it, they're still experiencing things, obviously. So they just need some help in figuring out, like, how do I process this fall? Why am I crying? And so what you do is you provide a narrative for them, meaning like, well, you were running and then you tripped and you fell and you hit your knee and that probably hurt a lot, but then mama came and gave you a Band-Aid and we cleaned it up and now you feel better, right? So you sort of also provide like a closing for them, like a resolution. And it's interesting to see what kinds of things, like with Simone, my daughter, the kinds of things that she will get hung up on and repeat over and over and over and over. And then you kind of have to like help her work through it by being like, okay, and then somebody came and gave you a hug and you felt better, right? Or, and then I think like the needs, it's interesting to see like how primal that is. I mean, to me, it seems like it's quite literally something that you start doing almost right away. It's like figuring out, how do you narrativize your experience? How do you tell it to other people? How do people tell it to you? How do you work through it? And also how that changes. Like presumably things, as she gets older, the things she gets hung up on will be different. It's less the fall and more that the kids are laughing at her, you know, or whatever, right? Like that there's like, that there's going to be a shift in terms of like the priorities and the understandings of the various ways in which like we narrativize ourselves.
I just want to say that my therapist the other day did this for me. And so maybe we don't change as much as you would think, because I had gotten really upset, like that my husband wouldn't make me extra, or he did do it, but he kind of grumbled when I was like, oh, can you make me an extra shot of coffee in the morning when we're rushing out the door? And so she walked me through the steps, like, let's take it real slow. And then the first thing, you wanted a cup of coffee. You felt rushed. You saw your husband was there by the coffee machine. We did this for like 30 minutes for a session. And it really did help because you kind of lose yourself sometimes. You can't track yourself in every moment and you check out.
Right.
So I think she was trying to check me back into myself and go through the actions with grammar, as she likes to say.
Oh, interesting.
Grammar is very important. Yeah.
She did like, Daddy, I want a coffee.
Daddy, I want a coffee. That's my book. That's, you find it in the traumatic lives section. Daddy, I want a coffee.
Wait, can I hazard one thing that I often say privately to my husband about every time I see some new memoir that's come out, which probably no one will agree with, not least of which the publishing industry. I kind of think that you should not write a memoir until you are in your 50s, in part because of the processing time and the maturation. Like, probably before I might have thought in your 40s, but I have come to see that, like, your 40s is just as turbulent and, like, confusing in many ways as, like, previous decades. But I think, like, by your 50s, you probably have, you've been through the cycles, you've reflected on things, you might have been to therapy. I think it's easier to write something that is truly interesting and teaches us something. Now, the only caveat to this is if something truly interesting has happened to you in your life, because, and then this is the last thing I'll say about this before we go into the scrum, but like, I think a lot of memoirs are written by people who may have wanted to write fiction, but couldn't quite figure out a story. And so they're like, I'll just write my story. And that we've also been in kind of a cultural moment where we want to hear everybody's story. And so that kind of has like a currency. But so many memoirs that I see are like the same story I've read a million times and just utterly uninteresting and don't teach me something.
But how old was, you know, my immediate thought is like, how old was George Orwell when he wrote Down and Out in Paris and London?
I guess that's true. And I'm holding him out as an interesting life because in some ways through the course of history, he has been received to me as a person who is interesting.
But he's also just, but also as I remember that book, which I, you know, read in my 20s, it was just a great story and he's a great writer. And I feel like a great writer can take any experience and make it interesting and worth reading, even if it's just like walking down to the store. You know, like something can happen. They can notice something. They can have a thought. Like, I think that we have that more and more this conception of what memoir is very narrow. Where actually memoir is not just about divulging trauma. It's about so much more. It can be very quotidian. You know, it can be a memoir of growing up in a country village, just letting you know what the ritual was. And those things, when they get hyper-specific and detailed, are fascinating to read. And I don't know if you have to wait until you're 50 to write about
probably. I told you, no, but I said at the jump, nobody would agree with me.
No, but I do see what you're saying when it's like a, you know, a 25-year-old memoir of like being a young Gen Z in New York City when I was 25. You know, like I'm not going to pick that up, but maybe like a little 21-year-old will. You know, they want to hear it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sure, but how different is that from the experience of any other person in their 20s that happens to be in, let's say, for example, New York, publishing, kind of culture writing? It's all very much the same as much as we want to believe that they're all individual and unique.
True. Well, something that's been like really occurring to me like throughout this conversation is like so much of what we're talking about is also really like heteronormative relationships, you know, like, I mean, aside, we've eventually pivoted to, like, parents, which is, like, you know, arguably more...
Can also be pretty heteronormative.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Can't do it differently, yeah.
Not necessarily, but also, I mean, you know, I think there, whatever, I'm not going to psychoanalyze our conversation, but I think there's something to be said to thinking about, like, partners and romantic partners and then thinking about, like, our relationships with our parents. I think that makes sense. But it's pretty... You know, this is a lot of this, I feel like, strikes me as like partly like, I wonder if we're like struggling again with like the sort of heteronormative, gender normative relationships that people have been struggling with for like a billion years. And that's partly also why this is feeling like so rehashed and old to you, Eric.
Yeah,
the fatigue of that. But also, why are we doing that? You know, like there's also like, but why is that happening? I wonder if it's partly a reaction to the kind of conversations that are happening around gender, to the sort of political turmoil that's happening around gender. Because, I mean, some of these essays like really directly sort of touch on that dynamic, on the sort of heteronormative dynamic between straight or ostensibly straight partners. And I feel like we're kind of losing, there's something being lost here about like queer narrative, like queer experience.
I think that's a great point. I mean, just in terms of, you know, I'm like imagining all, oh, here, what memoir would I be desperate to read? But I remember even in that book on fermentation, this is not a memoir, it's a cookbook. You guys know what I'm talking about? The guy, Sandra Katz.
No, I never read it.
Who lives in a radical...
No, I don't know this one.
Okay, it's called... I want to say it's called Magical Fermentation, but that could be wrong. It's by Sandra Katz. Great book. I love it. He lives in this community of radical fairies.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
And I believe he has HIV. And there's one part in the book where he's writing about... He went to the hospital. He planted these radishes before. And while he was in the hospital, he had a dream of these radishes. And when he got out, they had all... matured and he was able to eat them. And it was almost like some kind of manifest relationship between him and the radishes. Anyways, you know, like this is this one detail that it stayed with, touched me so much when I read it. And I've thought about it for ever since. And, you know, I would be so fascinated to know more about what it's like in this community. I mean, this is kind of along what you're saying, Eric, like all the stories are the same to Dea's point. There are also things I think that could really blow our minds in terms of we don't hear these stories as often. People living in very different, non-traditional, communal ways. You know, these are not the stories that are often put into the mainstream. Even like, you know, radical activists living communally, what they are willing to put on the line, all these things. No, it's not. That's not salacious. It's more about, yeah, I was cheated on or... I wanted to divorce my husband, you know, because from our middle class life. And it's also very middle class is what we're reading too.
Oh, very much. It's a 40-year-old white female divorcee. She's also the character typically at the center of much literary fiction, but we'll bracket that for now. But yes, for example, one of my favorite, it's complicated to call it a memoir, right? The term that Audre Lorde uses is biomythography. So this would be the book Zammy, which I loved and have long loved, not just for the unctuousness of the prose, like just how gorgeous and wonderful those sentences are, but also because she is telling me about an experience and a self-development that really feels like it's happening on every single page and that every page feels very fresh. Like that is a very old book at this point, but yet it feels alive with such freshness about a journey into sexuality, into sexual identity, into gender, into different living arrangements across like different countries. Like to me, that is like, I learn from that. I don't think I learn from much of the types of things that we're talking about. And I think that maybe to kind of like try to draw it full circle, like maybe this is also a publishing business thing, is that it's like, okay, well, who is the market? Maybe if we give the market stories that are kind of like the market's life, that's what they're going to gobble up. And to me, and I would imagine to a significant number of other people, that just feels like really disappointing and not like I'm getting something. Like that's what I turn to memoir for, is for a life that is very different that can cause a change in my own.
Well, maybe we can go around and see, like, Kate, what do you look for in like a personal essay? Eric said it's something that like makes him, is it like reconsider your own, Eric, or get a perspective on your own?
Yeah, it either is a different perspective that makes me think differently about my own life, or it shows me a different path that maybe I couldn't travel, but that I might have, and to learn from the experience of someone else's life.
I'll say kind of a complexity and richness of detail. As much as I also love like just kind of more like these like Marguerite Duras, like kind of these weird stories that are more about rhythm and don't have a lot of actual real hard, cold detail. Speaking of someone who did like a form of life writing often and wrote a lot of the same things, like I could live inside of one of her books, but you know, I love like when I read Family Lexicon, it's like all these funny little stories of a family. I even went to go see Charles Burnett the other night, the filmmaker who directed Killer of Sheep here, who was like, seems like someone who fiction films, but really specific, memorable details that stay with you. And his stories were hilarious and they were so specific and they were really small things about, you know, how he had tried to use this German Shepherd for one scene, but it wouldn't bark the way he wanted to. So he had end up using a little small dog that didn't seem scary, but it was, you know, it's like, I was laughing so much. And I think these real small stories that don't have anywhere else to go, memoir seems like the perfect container for them because they are like more vignettes than dramatic milieus. But I really like that like small detail.
I think mine is like boldness. Boldness in a variety of ways, but I think like boldness in terms of like revealing certain things about either oneself or one's experience or what literature can do. Like that there's like some risk there, I think I'm kind of looking for that. And I think you kind of get it in different ways and with different writers. Like I think with some people, it might almost feel like, oh, the risk is that in allowing this to feel like gossip, or the risk is in revealing this thing about your own personality that is like so unflattering, or the risk is boring your reader into a state of, well, like I think like the Knausgård novels, I mean, they're not memoir, right? But they are auto fiction, or, and you know, I think there's like a part there where it's like a extremely detailed description of cleaning a kitchen. It's a bold move because what you're doing is essentially allowing your prose to disinvite the reader from the narrative because there's no narrative. So I think when I see risk like that, and part of it is because like I feel like kind of incapable of doing that kind of thing. And so I'm like envious and attracted to it by virtue of feeling that, to me, I think it feels like a little bit inaccessible as a practice. I think that's what kind of draws me to it when I see that kind of risk happening.
All right. Well, how do we want to end it?
Just like tell a secret.
No.
Let's end with a secret.
Let's end with secrets that we're going to whisper into each other's ears and then sign off.
Or how about we could end with the title of our memoirs?
Yeah, let's do it. Title of memoir.
Oh, God.
What did I say? Daddy, I want a coffee.
Yours is Daddy, I want a coffee.
Okay.
Mine has, I think, for a long time been swaddled in knits.
Oh, yeah. I've heard you say that before. Swaddled in knits. The Medea Ocher story.
Yeah.
Or like, swaddled knits, my life as Medea Ocher.
One other quick psychoanalytic move. You've got Daddy in your title. I've got swaddled in mine. Eric?
Ooh, of course. Come on, Daddy.
I don't have one that is like so ready to hand. I would say like, I don't know, overthinking. Like, I feel like that's,
overthinking.
You know.
The Eric Newman story.
It's overthinking the Eric Newman story or talking myself out of it.
Ooh, that is
the
good.
The Eric Newman story.
Talking myself out of it. I really like that.
Out of the womb.
No wombs.
Thanks, Freud. Okay.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this special conversation episode of the LARB Radio Hour on the morality of memoir.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolfe, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vlotten.